Sports Radio. Again, thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited and honored to introduce you to my first guest today. His name is David Morey, and listen to this resume. He is the CEO of DMG Global and Vice Chairman of Core Strategy Group. They are some of the top strategic consultants in the world. He is also the co-author of a book that we're going to talk about extensively called The Underdog Advantage, published by McGraw-Hill. And he has helped hundreds of people raise a lot of money through revenue and increase value for their corporations. He has consulted some people that you may have heard of, including 5 Nobel Peace Prize winners and 16 winning global presidential people, including some guy named Barack Obama. Unbelievable, David. He has also consulted with Corazon Aquino, Boris Yeltsin, Vicente Fox, who was the president of Mexico, and the Dalai Lama. Unbelievable. He has helped companies like Verizon, Pepsi, GE, Mars, KPMG, McDonald's, Microsoft, American Express with their strategic vision. And he is also an adjunct professor at UPenn and also has served as a chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations Task Force on Public Diplomacy. Wow. David, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim. I'm getting tired just listening to you talk about me.
Well, it's an amazing resume, David. The next thing it says is you're going to take over the world and become supreme dictator.
Yeah, it's always it always sounds better than I think it really is, but we'll go with it. We'll go with it. Thank you, Jim, for those kind words.
Well, it's very impressive, and we're just honored to have you on the show today. You are the absolute antithesis of what you write about. You're the least underdog guy in the world. How do you know anything about being an underdog?
Oh, because we've all been underdogs in our lives. Believe me, I've been an underdog and continue to think that way when I can. Look, I'll tell you, there's a very serious point here. We're all at our best when we think like an underdog. You know, there are many examples of that. I used to be a decathlon competitor, and I always did my best when I was behind. I think, as soon as we get a lead, as soon as we have a success, a lot of us sort of start partying instead of pondering, what's the next step? How do I play more offense? You know, it's just a psychology. You know, you see it when you watch football or basketball games. One team gets ahead, and toward the end of the game, they start playing prevent defense. And what happens? Almost in any sport, the other team starts coming back, sometimes to even beat them in the end. So, you know, I think thinking like an underdog or an insurgent, as we call it in the business world, is a really important strategic advantage.
But it doesn't seem like many of your clients are the underdog. American Express, McDonald's, Microsoft, Barack Obama. These are not the underdog, are they? Aren't these people and these corporations the creme de la creme when it comes to whatever role they are playing in society or in business?
Well, that's a great question. We actually work with two kinds of companies. We work with big companies, like you mentioned, that want to go back to their insurgent underdog roots. You know, they have forgotten the kind of strategic values, the way of thinking in some cases that got them there in the first place. And we also work with very small companies. We work with a couple accelerators, some companies, startup companies we think you're going to hear about someday soon. We do both because we learn a lot, and I know a lot of your listeners work with small companies. We learn a lot from those small companies. In fact, most of the innovation, all the research shows, and you know this from your work, most of the research today happens out in the periphery, in these small companies. You know, that Warren Buffett talks about the garages in America that created companies like Nike and Apple and HP, or the dorm room that created Facebook. That's where all this innovation is happening. So in some ways, we love working with those small companies to give them some of the strategic underdog skills in a formal sense that have built great companies. And then we love going to big companies because they pay very well, and they have to be reminded, how do you get back to that insurgent underdog culture that got you there, as I said, in the first place?
All right. Is it possible for a company like Comcast to have any sense of underdog advantage? I'm a Comcast customer, and they treat me like they're the big guy on the block. They could care less about me. They don't have any underdog. And I picked that company because I don't think it's one of your clients.
Correct.
how can a company like that, when they're worth $100 billion, keep this mentality of being an underdog?
Well, I mean, they're going to have to. You know, we have friends at Comcast, and we would tell them this publicly and privately. They're going to have to go back to the roots of the underdog. I mean, you know, what you're saying is true for every cable company in America. You know, all the, I mean, you know, they're at the very bottom, even below political leaders today in terms of popularity surveys. You know, they're going to have to work harder, or they're going to get outmaneuvered by other companies. By other companies coming at them from different places, like Netflix, for example, or even Apple. I mean, you know, these companies are starting to converge on each other's territory. So, excuse me. So, Jim, you've got to, I mean, for example, Comcast and companies like Comcast have to get closer to their customer. You know, they have to begin to think much more strategically. How does that customer think? You know, and when you have a dissatisfied customer, you got to define the expectations, over-deliver against them, and remind them that you just did it. You know, they got to go back to basics. Here's an example. What's the most popular airline in the United States most years? You know, as your
Southwest.
Listeners are thinking. Yeah, and they promise nothing, but they get you there, and they over-deliver on that expectation at a very cheap price. They remind you of how much fun you had when you took the flight. Whereas, you know, United and American and Delta, you know, I'm owe for 3 million miles on the experience they promised me in their commercials. You know, everyone's flying first class with a beautiful wine, you know, goblet and filet mignon and beautiful flight attendants. I'm, you know, you don't ever sort of meet that expectation of perfect service. They do the opposite. So, you know, in the case of Comcast, companies like Comcast that are big and incumbent, they've got to begin to think smaller. They got to begin to think, you know, like Comcast was built by Brian Roberts' father. You know, back in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, they had a stronger customer service ethic. They got to go back to that. You know, and companies lose their way on this insurgent, you know, platform. You know, Apple is a great example of losing its way and finding its way again. Often the founder comes back to remind the companies how they got there in the first place, how they got close to the customer, how they listened to the customer, how they listened to what you're saying, you know, how they didn't sort of create the feeling they're overcharging the customer, how they delighted the customer. The truth today is, in the social media world, you know, who knows how much damage your comment causes to Comcast. Comcast had a website attacking Comcast. I hate Comcast, or ComcastSucks.com, right? So, you know, in this social media age, you have one bad customer experience, it proliferates to hundreds of examples of word of mouth. And today, word of mouth, whether it's on social media or in person, at dinner parties, is everything in marketing.
Well, I talk incessantly poorly about Comcast because they just drive me crazy. Maybe we need to redefine the word underdog. How can a big company be scrappy? Because when I think of underdog, David, I think of getting down in the mud and getting dirty and being really scrappy and doing anything that they can think of to come back ahead. And maybe even cheating a little bit, and certainly not having a bureaucratic meeting to discuss their new vision of their corporate policy. You know, if you're an underdog, you just go out there and say, hey, we're going to win, and we're going to beat you up, and we're going to fight back hard. Is that a definition that is applicable to what a big business needs to do?
Yeah, a great question. Again, Jim, in some ways, the underdog is a description of the place where you are in the battle. It's really, you're David versus Goliath. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell, a friend of mine, has written about this beautifully. You know, we, in business terms, often define underdog as an insurgent versus an incumbent. The incumbent has the marketplace leadership, and therefore they get lazy and bureaucratic and formal and ritualistic, and they hate change. By default, they start playing defense. That sounds like a lot of big companies, maybe some that you've mentioned. The insurgent, by the other hand, in business, they move faster. They're more strategic, like David was against Goliath. You know, they're more agile, more mobile, more customer-focused. And these folks, these insurgents in the business world, love change because they love disrupting the status quo because they're not leading the status quo. So they love doing so. And so, therefore, you get companies like, I mean, think of this, as David Brooks wrote in a recent column, Uber, the largest taxi company in the world, owns no vehicles. You know, Alibaba, the largest retailer in the world, has no inventory. You know, Facebook, and Facebook at one point was an insurgent, you know, an underdog. Facebook, the largest owner of media content, creates no media content. You know, they find a different way to do it. You know, they find a way to disrupt the status quo. So in some ways, the key word is change. And this is as true for big companies that we advise and big CEOs that are famous as it is for listeners on your radio now that, you know, that are running, you know, small companies. You know, I believe that this underdog insurgent spirit is in the American small company, where most of the revenues and jobs are, by the way. And they really need to find a way to get at some change in their marketplace and begin disrupting it. And as you disrupt and as you drive some kind of change strategy, look at what Jobs did in creating Apple. Every great company in America, you know, over the last 30 years has been founded on the principle of change. It's what, by the way, is working in politics today. Around the world, the people that are reelected are being reelected or being elected on change platforms. And, you know, and to digress, go ahead.
You go ahead. You wanted to digress. I love
digressions. Well, I mean, let me give you a great example. Pope Francis is coming to Philadelphia in September. The number one respected leader in the world today is Pope Francis. Isn't that interesting? You know, because he's the most change-focused pope in centuries. He's trying to transform change in an institution that's thousands of years old. So I think when political leaders get in trouble today, they stop thinking about change, you know, and they start protecting the status quo. Because people now expect, you know, some kind of change. You know, we're all a little bit afraid of change, yet we still want change. We want progress. So, you know, what we find in the business world is that the leaders that are standing for some kind of change in the marketplace tend to be the winning leaders.
But, you know, you mentioned a group of companies there, Uber, Alibaba, Facebook. It's very interesting how quickly these companies lose their underdog advantage and become part of the ugly status quo. When I think of Uber, the first thing that comes to my mind is not who I can get a really cheap taxi ride. It's they don't treat their employees well. They don't even have employees. They are all independent contractors, and so I know they're getting screwed. And I have a negative connotation of Facebook. To me, they are the evil empire personified now, the way they treat my privacy, the way they have become super big corporate America where they're only out to make more money. And I think a lot of people have a very negative view of these companies so quickly. You know, Uber burst onto the scene 4 or 5 years ago. And already almost all of the PR about them is negative. Do you think my views are incorrect?
Well, I think that you're underlining, Jim, how important it is for companies once they get to the success level of the incumbent, the top dog, they've got to go back to those roots again and again and again. I mean, you know, Apple has been lost and found itself. Google has been lost and found itself. You know, a lot of those companies get to really high. I mean, look at the market caps of the two examples you cited. I mean, both Uber and Facebook, these are gigantic, gigantic companies. And you get that big, you know, you can start to lose, you know, your ear for what got you there. You know, standing up for change in a way that's friendly to the consumer, you know, looking out for that consumer. And so you see, for example, Facebook constantly making adjustments in that area, not always getting it right by their own admission, but constantly making adjustments. The same for Uber, trying to get, you know, more of this right. And what it does is it opens up opportunities for the next Uber and the next Facebook to come at them. You know, it's almost the Darwinian organic reality of the marketplace. You know, there's just always, there's always room for a consultant to help a top dog act like an underdog as they were in the beginning and when they became great. And there's always room for a new competitor to come in and start disrupting these incumbents that think they're the best thing that ever happened, that start believing their own press releases.
Right. Okay, so how can our listeners, small business people, as they start to have success and they get to $10 million a year in sales, how can they maintain their scrappiness and their underdog advantage? So we've talked about Steve Jobs bringing that back to Apple. How can we not lose it in the first place, David, and maintain it? How do we keep that entrepreneurial spirit alive even as we start to settle into a status quo where I made $10 million last year. Don't tell me we want to change my company because then I might make $8 million or go out of business. You know, I grew a business to 700 employees, David, back in the 90s. And as my brother, for example, came in, he had all these brilliant ideas on how to make the company better. I was like, hell no, we're not going to change a damn thing because we know this formula works. And if you want to change anything, it might break my formula.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great question. I'll give you three general answers and we can get specific. Every company, every situation is different, but there's strategic common denominators in The Underdog Advantage and the two sequels coming out this year and next that kind of go into more specifics. But the first piece of advice for companies that you describe is, number one, they've got to really think, we would argue, like a campaign. And that specifically means stop and get close to your customers again. You know, really go talk to those customers. Listen. You know, as Jobs, who was our first corporate client and really helped invent our insurgent model, gave us the word insurgent, by the way, back in the 80s. As Jobs said, you've got to begin with the consumer and move back to the technology, not the other way around. So if you're a technology company, if you're whatever kind of company, don't begin with that. Start with that consumer and those, you know, in-depth interviews, walk around and listen, just get on a plane, go on foot, really talk and understand who those customers are, where are they going, what are their needs and wants. The second thing is you got to be open to thinking differently today. You know, you've got to be more flexible, more agile in your own thinking. You know, we have a section in the keynotes I do called Think Like a Magician because it's a hobby of mine going out of control. And, you know, magicians are great at disrupting, you know, your perceptions and the status quo. And that's the way CEOs today have to think. They've got to be able to go outside of the box and think differently about the challenges coming at them. And then thirdly, and most importantly, the leader today has to play offense. Here's a statistic that underlines it. 49% of a company's brand and reputation today comes down to the CEO. What they say, what they don't say, the thought leadership that they put forward. You have a job now as CEO of being an expert about your customers and what they need and where they're going and what that part of the industry represents. That's so critical now. And by playing offense, I mean, you know, being more strategic about operationalizing, about executing, better prioritization, getting close, as I say, to customers, moving your most valuable customers to greater loyalty. That's probably the secret sauce of all. I mean, going to your loyal customers, we call them loyal voters, and getting them to buy one more, getting them to do one more thing, recommend one more product or service, that is usually where most businesses can grow the easiest and the most effectively. So, I mean, those are some quick examples of the kind of things that CEOs have to be thinking about today to move to the next level.
All right, we're about to run out of time, David, and I don't normally talk politics on this show. I just don't think it's appropriate, but I do want to ask you one political question. Who embodies change in the next U.S. presidential election? I certainly don't think of Hillary Clinton as a embodiment of change. I think of her as the status of the status of the status quo. You know, nothing more embodies the way we used to do something than Hillary Clinton. So what are your thoughts? That's my personal opinion. What are your thoughts, David, on who embodies change out there now and what's going to be the exciting change that is promised in the next presidential cycle?
That's a great and a tough question. I take the assumption of it seriously because, we have found, back to what I said, the leaders winning today, just like the business leaders succeeding, are standing for change. They're not afraid of it. They're not afraid of disrupting. And I think you're right. Hillary Clinton has a challenge here because she's perceived as a status quo politician with a lot of experience. In some ways, she represents a third term of Barack Obama and a third term of Bill Clinton. And Americans, by the way, are not crazy about third terms. We get a little tired. You know, they're not been, you know, I think, you know, in some ways, maybe we could say Herbert Walker Bush represented a third Reagan term. But other than that, we haven't had any of those, third terms in a long, long time. And in fact, we've had four change elections in a row, depending on how you count. four change elections in a row. So, you know, Hillary's got a challenge. Jeb Bush has a challenge because he represents a third term of his brothers, right? So, you know, the two front runners now in some ways don't represent what I'm talking about, which is a change candidate, a change leader. And, you know, someone independent, a business leader putting a lot of money in, you know, other than Trump, maybe Trump's going to disrupt this campaign more than people think, would actually get a lot of traction today, we think. You know, there's a great desire for a third party, independent party, someone who gets above politics and starts doing something. You know, any candidate who gets into that space who says, you know, forget the politics, I'm going to start fixing this, we're going to clean up the fundraising scandals, we're going to get balance the books, we're going to actually make Washington work, will have a tremendous advantage. Now, watch both Jeb, Hillary, and the other candidates try and get there. For some of them, it's going to be very hard. You know, for some of them, it's going to be very hard. We'll see who has a better chance of getting there. And no one gets reelected today, Jim, without being the change candidate. So there's, you know, some ways, even though you're incumbent, you can still stand for change. And that's what both Hillary and Jeb are going to have to try and do to win the election.
And it's interesting that we all dismiss Trump immediately. He is the biggest change, but I think that we all acknowledge that his negatives are what, around 70 or 80%. And so we consider him unelectable, but he represents the biggest change possible. Don't you think that using your standard of change, that he is the one that percolates to the top and maybe has an interesting chance? But I noticed you dismissed him almost immediately. I certainly do. I'd love to see someone like him, as you said, a business leader. But I just think that his ego and weird hair and past and all of that make it really, and what has he had? Four bankruptcies with his company? I think that starts to weigh against him too. Why do we dismiss Trump so readily when he is the biggest change agent out there?
I think it's a mistake to do so. I agree with you. I mean, I think we dismiss him because of, you know, people think of him as a reality show and the media dismisses him. But don't dismiss him. He's going to disrupt this race and these debates in a way that helps Trump a lot, move higher and higher. I think Trump's going to do better than people think. And people that are coming in this race as outsiders or as change agents, we'll make a mistake to not keep an eye on John Kasich, for example, who's had a strong record as Ohio governor.
Yeah, but he's at 0.1% right now.
Exactly. I mean,
he's
exactly.
Not even going to make the top 10 debate over there on Fox.
He may not, you know, which would be ironic because the first debate
is in his city. State. Yeah.
Can you imagine? So, I think Chris Christie is underestimated because he's coming in rabble rising and saying, I'm changing. Watch these candidates all go for the word change. You know, watch them try and define on their own terms what changes. By the way, this means Hillary's going to have to run to some extent against part of Barack Obama's legacy.
Yes.
You know, and that's expected. I think you're right about Trump. And keep an eye, the listener should keep an eye out for the candidate that gets a hold of the word change. It can't be Obama's version in 08. It's got to be like real change. It can't be the idea of change. It's got to be, I'm going to actually reform this stuff, turn it around, fix the problem.
And if the Donald came to you and tried to hire you, David, would you take him on as a client?
I don't know. We have never worked on that side of the aisle, even though I'm a real independent at heart. We'll always talk to people. We probably wouldn't work on the Republican side of the aisle. But I admire Trump for finally getting in. It's not easy to run for office these days, you know, and even though you got a lot of money like him, it's not a comfortable process. And I think one thing the viewers, the listeners would probably agree with is we're not necessarily attracting the best people in our system.
No.
You know, because who wants to run for office today, you know?
That's right.
You'd rather have a radio show. We can't convince people like you, Jim, that should be, you know, in the political process to get in because it's just so distasteful and so disheartening. We're going to have to change that. You know, we're going to have to change the way money comes into this political system because we got to attract better people into public office.
Well, I think I would be an amazing president, David, but I tell you, I have more skeletons in my closet than are in the National Cemetery there at Arlington. So I disqualified myself back in the 80s 600 different ways. David, how can we find out more about you, get a copy of your book, follow you on that social media stuff?
Yeah, go to playoffense.com. It's pretty simple. And you can get a copy of the book. Get to our corporate website is dmghq, www.playoffense.com, BMGHQ.com, but www.playoffense.com, show you where you can get the book in bookstores. We've got two sequels coming out, CEO is Candidate, about leadership in both big companies and small. How do you do what we've been talking about today? And the rise of the insurgent brands. You know, how do these great new companies form themselves? How do you become one of those companies that gets to a whole new level of success? So the listeners are welcome to come on and, you know, start getting in a dialogue with us on social media about some of these issues.
David, I appreciate you greatly being with us today and hope you'll come back when the new books come out. Congratulations.
You got it. Look forward to it. And I guess, Jim, think about that presidential run. This could be the moment where it started.
Well, would you represent me? That's all I need to know. Would you hire
me? We could do that.
Me?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's not me hiring you. You would have to select me.
Exactly. I think, look, you've already got a base. Listen to all these people listening to you now. Look at all these people listening to you now.
Well, yeah, but they know about my closet full of skeletons. I've told some of them on the show in the past, so there's too much out there about me, David. You know, that thing I did with goats to get into that fraternity, you know. So anyway.
Yeah, I know.
David Morey, thank you so much.
Burn the pictures.
Yeah, that's right. At least they didn't have Facebook back when I did all that stuff. David Morey, thank you so much for being with us, and I greatly appreciate it.
We're looking forward to keeping in touch, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you. We will be right back with more in just a minute.